Well, as long as I can remember, I've heard about people who are interested in UFOs, who are interested in extraterrestrial life. You know, some people have been captivated by the possibility that there is life very similar to what we know and experience as life on some other planet out there in our solar system or in the whole universe. You know, even of scientists who generally are pretty logical thinkers and have a reputation for being bright people, that a lot of them are caught up in this theory that there really is life very similar to what we know out there on another planet in great outer space. To the really hardcore UFO chasers, Area 51, the classified Air Force base in southern Nevada, is kind of like Mecca to them. The place really, it truly is mysterious because it's highly classified. It has to be highly classified because it's the Air Force base where they are developing new weapons, military aircraft. And because it's highly classified like that, there's been a lot of theories going around about what is actually taking place on Area 51 and what actually is included there. And the really hardcore UFO people are quite sure that's where the government keeps all of the flying saucers that they've captured over the years. So, is there really life on another planet or somewhere in the universe? Well, who knows? God knows. Because if there is, he put it there. And before we dismiss the idea of life being somewhere, existing somewhere other than planet Earth, we need to acknowledge this morning that there really is a parallel universe, an alternative dimension. And you're sitting there saying, Pastor, are you a science fiction kind of guy? Do you really believe that? Well, I really do. Why? I think Scripture bears it out. How does your Bible begin? Mine begins like this, Genesis 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Where was he? Where is he now? Remember what Jesus told the Samaritan woman, the woman at the well? He said, God is a spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. He's not the only one. God warns us that Satan is the prince and the authority of this air or the sphere of this world. Daniel learned in chapter 10, 11, and 12, if you go back and read Daniel, that these spirit powers have a lot of authority. In fact, they have some kind of impact, some kind of influence on the nations of this world. And that's why Paul would tell us who are followers of Jesus Christ that we need to be very diligent and we need to be aggressive putting on spiritual armor. Why? We need to pray as we put on this armor because we stand against the schemes of the devil. Why? Ephesians 6, verse 11, 12. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood. We're wrestling against rulers, against authorities, against cosmic powers over this present darkness, against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. I'm telling you, there's an alternative dimension. There's a parallel universe. It's the spirit world. So what goes on in the spirit world? What goes on in that other dimension? How do decisions made and actions taken in the spirit world impact your life and my life? One thing we know for certain is that God is in control of every detail of the entire universe, invisible and visible. That gives us confidence. He controls every matter of the universe for his glory. That means that God creates and controls circumstances to bring glory to himself, even in the smallest, most minute matters. I just read this morning in my devotion, Matthew chapter 10, verse 29. When a sparrow falls to the ground, it cannot happen without God. And generally, we interpret that to mean, you know, God knows about it. That's not what the text says. God does it. In the smallest things, He's in control. Well, one day, there was this huge conference in heaven, in this other dimension. And it resulted in life-changing ramifications on earth. In particular, the circumstances from that meeting crushed the righteous, godly man named Job. He had no idea what had been determined in God's counsel. He had no earthly understanding of why his very pleasant life suddenly was destroyed. How did he respond? We need to pay real close attention to Job's response, because it's pretty much the best way that we can expect to respond when God is gaining glory for Himself, us knowing that He is faithful, that He is trustworthy, that He is just in everything. So we see from this text very simply, God's controlling authority as it's revealed in two scenes that took place in heaven but had ramifications on earth. Furthermore, Job's response reveals that he really did trust God, because he really was God's child, because God really made him righteous. A divine test. This story of Job is built on an unseen agreement that put this special servant of God to a serious test. Came about when God is the one who suggested to Satan to consider his servant Job. God's question, verse 6, comes in the context of this day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came, and the Lord brought it up. Verse 7, he said to Satan, from where have you come? Satan's answer, of course, hanging out on the earth. Well, what is this? You know, what's taking place here? Well, you have the sons of God. That is a reference to the angels that God had created. Angelic beings, apparently, periodically, they go before God and they give a report as to the work that they have been doing out in God's universe. They're answerable to God because He is their creator. This is not a matter of equals working together. This is a matter of a subordinate reporting to an authority, the supreme authority, God the Creator. And that is especially the case, we must remember that, as Satan comes as one of those created beings to report to his superior God. And he is a very negative character. In fact, the word Satan, the title Satan, it's a description. It's not just a name. This is a description. In fact, in your text in the Hebrew, it is the Satan, a particular kind of being. The word speaks of an adversary, an enemy, the one who causes trouble and who accuses. You notice all through Scripture, this is the one who resists God, works against God, works against God's creatures and against all of God's creation, always accusing God of being unfair and unjust. That's what Satan does. He is the Satan. And that was very obvious in the Garden of Eden when you have Satan right away working through this serpent. And what is he doing? He's accusing God of being unfair, God being unjust. And he's attacking God's created beings in order to do that. He lies to Eve about her creator, God. He is definitely not God's equal. That's very important for us to remember that. And so here Satan is doing what Satan does. He's building up an accusation that God is unfair, that God has not been justified in the way that he has pampered his servant Job and protected him. And what he's doing is he's setting up a case. He's going to set up a test so that he can put this creature that God has made righteous under pressure, put him to the test so that this creature will do what Satan does, accuse God of being unfair, accuse God of being unjust, and ultimately cursing God. It is exactly the picture of what Satan does all the time as he goes through this earth, up and down in the earth, as he admits, falsely accusing, causing all kinds of mischief in the world. And God is now calling him into account for his evil deeds. And Satan says, yeah, I've been out there going to and fro across the earth, basically meaning I'm out there in your creation, God, looking for trouble, causing trouble everywhere I go. And then God poses the question. Has something to do with his own work in his own servant Job. Verse 8, the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him in the earth, blameless, upright, fears God, turns away from evil. And the very fact that God calls him his servant, I mean, we see that all through the New Testament, you know, the servant Paul, and, you know, the servant Peter, and Christ's servant, yeah, you know, we're called to be Christ's servants. We often lose sight of what that means. This relationship between Job and God pictures Job, the word that's used here is literally a slave, or we might use the word bond slave. And that's what Paul called himself. God says, have you considered this guy who's sold himself into slavery to me? He loves me. He fears me. He avoids evil. Wait a minute. How does a person who is born a sinner, how does a person who is born in bondage, a slave to sin, how does that person become a slave to God and love God and fear God and serve God? And how does a person who is born a sinner, rebelling against God, become a person who loves God? Well, maybe the Old Testament people were different than the New Testament people. Maybe we don't understand what was happening. No, we do understand what's happening. You have to realize that salvation is salvation. Redemption is redemption. Being made righteous is being made righteous, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament. And it all happens because of the grace of God. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 and verse 9 fit very, very well in the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. By grace we are saved through faith still. And God's greatest glory to himself is brought to him through his trophies of grace, us, Job. And so God says to Satan, the troublemaker, have you considered this sinner who I have made righteous, who is my servant? You look at Satan's response and it's obvious that he knew Job. Satan doesn't say to God, who? He knows exactly who he is. And he knew very well that what God said about Job, this is a blameless man, he's righteous, he eschews evil, he stays away from evil. Satan knew that was true. But now he's going to argue about why. You know, why is Job like that? In our context, our words, now, why is Job so religious? He proposes this test. I'm going to show to you, God, he isn't what you think he is. Verse 9. Satan answers the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around his house and all that he has on every side? Have you blessed his work of his hands? His possessions have increased. God, you stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. Who curse you to your face? Do you see this? You know what Satan is proposing here? He is talking about the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. You know that's a false gospel, right? And you know it's been preached for years in our country, right? And you know a lot of your friends and neighbors have bought into it, right? And it's a lie of Satan. And right now that's what he's proposing. Come on, God. It's a health, wealth, prosperity thing. You blessed Job like that. And that's why he loves you, and that's why he serves you, and that's why he looks like a servant. He's only walking with you because you've blessed him financially, and you've blessed his family. You know, there's no telling how many professing Christians in your culture, in your neighborhood, are guilty of this very accusation from Satan. They are walking with God, supposedly. They are in fellowship with God, supposedly, only because life's great. It looks like God blessed them. It's often been said that a good dose of persecution would empty churches in America. I've said that myself on occasion. Why? Well, because persecution brings reality to the surface. There really was not faith in God there at all. You had ulterior motives for serving the Lord. And you know, that may actually be true. It may be happening right now before us. You do a little research and you ask a few questions and have a few conversations and you just realize that churches are already feeling a lot of shrinkage right now because of COVID. Pastors all over America are reporting that church attendance has become, because church attendance has become very, very difficult, inconvenient. For some people, it's just impossible. So that in many cases in their churches, just as would happen with persecution, people are saying to them, you know, it's too inconvenient, it's too hard. In fact, it's become impossible. You know what? I'm just giving up. I'm done with the whole thing. I'm not going to be back. And this is happening by the hundreds, even in Greenville. When trouble comes, people who are merely religious really don't have a reason to trust God. If they've been trusting Him for the wrong reason, they have no reason to trust the God who authorizes the trouble. Well, failing to believe in God's work of grace in the life of Job, Satan challenges God. Reach out and touch him and see how he reacts. He'll curse you. Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. That involves God directly. It's not indirect. This is direct. You see, it's not only that in this story God allows Satan to touch his servant Job, but by God authorizing it, God is responsible for this test. God is responsible for this judgment. He is the authority behind it. And it's really hard for us who really trust God and love God to come to grips with this fact that God gave permission to Satan to do this. Verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hands." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And, you know, granting this permission is the same as authorizing the test. And God just very simply in his statement turned all of the material blessings and family blessings over to Satan. They're yours. Why? Because God is going to prove to Satan that when he makes a person righteous, that person is righteous and stays righteous. You see, what's at stake here is really not Job's well-being, Job's good life. What is at stake here is God's character, his reputation. He's going to prove a very critical, important principle that you must believe. Paul wrote to the Philippian Christians and said, "I am sure of this, that he began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. Folks, when God redeems a person, that person's redeemed. Because if that person fails and is not born again and somehow loses salvation, that's God's character that failed. See, proving this reality right here is the whole purpose for this test. And it could be any kind of a test. David Klein, for example, writes in his book that it would be possible for God to do an obverse kind of a test like this. And here's this very poor servant of God who has a very difficult life, struggling to get along, and God just does this test of that person and pours out incredible financial blessing. Maybe he wins the lottery because God made it work. And this principle says incredible financial blessing will not ruin a sinner. A saint who was a sinner and has been redeemed will not cause that person to quit trusting God and start trusting finances. You see, either test is serious, right? One test is as bad as the other. Here is Job, who's incredibly wealthy. Is he going to stop trusting God when the wealth is gone? Here's a poor saint who's incredibly poor. Will he stop trusting God when he becomes incredibly wealthy? No, not if he's a saint. He will have the wisdom of Solomon, Proverbs 30, verse 8. Remove far from me falsehood and lying. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me. Trust God regardless. And God says, okay, let's do the test. Go ahead, Satan. All his possessions, his family, they're in your hands. And do this test so that the whole world can see. Let's let the world watch here. And while the world's watching, Job loses all his blessings. You read that verse 14 through 17. All those possessions of livestock that he had, gone. All his servants, killed. Each case, totally unexpected. Nobody saw this coming. I mean, you look, the Sabians attack, verse 15. Yeah, who were they? They're a marauding band. Why did they pick on Job? I mean, they could have gone anywhere. It was on purpose. Fire from God, verse 16. That's probably lightning. Who predicted that? I mean, who could see that coming? There's a reason why the insurance companies today call that an act of God. It was an act of God. The Chaldeans attack, verse 17. He loses everything. What did Job do to them? Why was Job considered to be there? It was from God. You have four very unexpected disasters. Two come from people. Enemies, not personal enemies. I mean, Job just happened to be there. Really difficult to foresee, impossible to prevent. Two of these disasters are natural disasters, lightning, wind, tempest. No, nobody can control that. Job loses everything, including his family. Verse 18, 19. Here are Job's children. They're all together. They're not acting notoriously evil. They're just doing what they normally did. Very unusual, highly unusual accident happens. And a tornado, and they're the path of the tornado, or whatever you want to call it. And all his children are killed. How'd Job respond? Well, verse 20 and 21 makes me wonder how I would respond if I was in a situation even close to that. And as we would expect, I mean, Job has a lot of grief. Verse 20, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, worshipped. the robe that speaks of here is the outer garment that he'd be wearing. Of course, he's rich. He's the richest man in the East. He's going to have on a beautiful robe, a highly ornamented robe. It's going to show that he is wealthy. It's going to show that he is rich. It's going to identify him as the privileged class, the upper class, what we call the 1%. His clothing, his robe, is going to indicate to anybody who's watching, you know, Job is part of that 1%, and suddenly it doesn't matter. Who cares? I mean, suddenly he's not part of the 1%. So he rips his robe, symbolism that really didn't fit at that point, shaved his head, indication of mourning, fell on the ground, grief, exhaustion, emotions wiped out, and the very next word says, and he worshiped. He worshiped. In fact, falling down is so connected with that word worship. In the Hebrew, the word that's translated worship means to fall down or bow down. It's an act of humility. Worship is not us raising ourselves up to the level of God so that we can be on His level and we communicate with God and tell Him what a wonderful guy He is. Worship is us falling down in humility, recognizing who He is and who we are. Submission before Him. And Satan is saying, oh, I'm nuts. He didn't get the response he was looking for. Job didn't rebel. Job didn't curse God. He didn't even blame God for his disasters. Hey, Satan is so wrong here. Look at Job's conclusions. Verse 21, he says, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave, the Lord's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job didn't sin or charge God with wrong. Wow. How did he ever come to that conclusion? Well, folks, you have to understand, Job is a righteous man. He loves God, and therefore he has the wisdom of God. And even though Proverbs had not been collected by the time Job's story takes place, almost certainly, he understood wisdom. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 15, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. Naked as he came, he shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hands. Job understood that. Ecclesiastes 12:7, as the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Job understood all this. Job just understood he was born dying. Do we get it? Do we ever think about the fact that we were born dying? Next time somebody says, hey, how you doing? Say, I'm dying. Well, number one, they're going to wonder if you have a disease you haven't been telling anybody about. Or number two, they're going to think, you're a really, really negative person, but you're really very realistic. I'm dying. And anything that I have in this very short life, I have only because God gave it to me. Do you see your possessions that way? It's not mine, it's God's. We agree with James, chapter 1, verse 17. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. And Job understood this. God gives freely. Everything that I have, God gave me. It's not because I'm bright. It's not because I'm a hard worker. It's not because I've had all these opportunities. God gave it to me. And that means God can take it away. And when he dies, whether he gives or takes, it always shows that God is good and God is wise. That's why Job responded to God's actions like this. Verse 21, blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God wrong. God was right. Satan was wrong. Now, once we finally kind of digested that, say, wow, that was a little frightening there where God gave permission to Satan. Well, the testing increases. And this is where it really gets hard to believe. I mean, as if the first story is not bad enough, you come to the second story and you read about a second agreement. Chapter 2, verse 1 through verse 7. Again, you know, same scenario. Satan goes before God. God points out, hey, Satan, Job's still steadfast. I mean, even after this incredible testing, what does God say about him? Verse 3, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth, a blameless, upright man who fears God, turns away from evil. Hey, Satan, there's Job, standing like a rock. He hasn't wavered. He's still blameless. He's still upright. He still fears me. He still turns away from evil. He's still my bondslave. Last part of verse 3, very important statement. He still holds fast his integrity. Why? How? If you were Job, and if I were Job, how would we ever hold fast and not blame God and not curse him with our lips? The answer to that is sustaining grace. The same grace that saves us from the penalty of our sin is sufficient to sustain us in the face of hardships and trouble. Why is Job holding on to his integrity? The answer is very simple. He was empty of self and fully dependent upon God. And whatever God dished out, he took. Satan was betting on the fact that Job would fail because he would come to the conclusion that God's grace was not sufficient. It was not enough to sustain him. And ultimately, Satan's the one who's to be blamed. God pointed that out, verse 3. Look, Satan, you incited me against him to destroy him without a reason. That's what happened. Satan had challenged God to destroy his servant. And yet this therefore becomes a story that is not so much about the servant as this was an attack by Satan against God. Job just happens to be the pawn on the chessboard. This is whether God is faithful, whether God has integrity. Can you trust God? And in this, you will notice this statement in verse 3, God takes full responsibility. You incited me. Satan, you pressed me to do something very unusual. You stirred me to act against my servant. Folks, remember this. God is always in the test. There's nothing outside his control. There's nothing out of bounds. There's nothing where God would say, oh, how did that happen? He's in the test. See cases of that. You know when Saul's chasing David? Remember one of those cases where David caught him, basically, could have killed him and didn't? He said in 1 Samuel 26, verse 19, if it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it's men who have stirred you up against me, may they be cursed. David understands God. And he says, you know, it's possible that God stirred you up. Remember when Shimei is cursing David? David's running away for his life, away from Absalom. And good old Joab, you love him, you know. I'm going to go over and take his head off. David said, no. Maybe God told him to curse me. Maybe God is inciting this man against me? You know, David's in the middle of another one of these cases at the end of his reign, 2 Samuel 24 and verse 1. God is angry with the Israelites because they're so rebellious against him. And so what does he do? He incites David against his people. And yet as you read further, you realize, just like in the case of Job, ultimately, it was Satan because he is the worker of evil. It was Satan who ultimately stirred David to number the people. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1. Satan stood against Israel, incited David to number Israel. Very similar situation to what we have here. Job, he had done nothing to give God a reason to allow him to suffer. You know, even Satan acknowledged that. Chapter 1, verse 9. Does Job fear God for no reason? Well, God just simply threw that accusation right back into Satan's face. You incited me against him with no reason. And even you admit that, Satan. And yet, in spite of all that, God gave Satan permission to do it again. Even worse. Verse 4, thus Satan answered the Lord, and he says, skin for skin, all that a man has, you give for his life. Stretch out your hand, touch his bone and his flesh, he'll curse you to your face. What? You know, I guess if nothing else, you have to be able to conclude that Satan is at least persistent. Yeah, I would have thought he'd have given up at this point. Okay, God, you're right. Again, still, no, not Satan. He's not like that. More accusations. You know, a person's going to be willing to give up everything in life in order to protect his own life. We know that. We just have this innate desire to survive. So, therefore, God, you just take away Job's health. Make it look like Job's dying. He'll curse you because he won't have anything else to live for. What a wicked, wicked being Satan is. To our shock, God gives him permission. Verse 6. The Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, only spare his life. Again, God's drawing the boundaries. He's saying, here's the fence. You can go this far. You can't kill him. You can test him in his health as much as you want, but I'm setting the limits. Satan went out, struck Job. Again, everybody saw it. Verse 7. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Now, as Satan strikes Job with this sickness, we're reminded that all sickness is rooted in the sin principle, right? Every sickness is because of sin. If there had been no sin by Adam and Eve, there'd be no sickness. But sometimes bad health is a result of God creating an opportunity for him to bring glory to himself, right? Remember the disciples? They see the man who's born blind. Their question to Jesus is what? Who sinned, this man or his parents? Jesus said, no, that's not the issue here. This is simply an opportunity for God to be glorified. You got the case with Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. You have Paul with this thorn in the flesh, whatever it might be. It was something to do with his physical or maybe even his emotional well-being. God put that there. And Paul says, I asked God three times to get rid of it. And God says, no, I'm bringing glory to myself by showing you that my grace is sufficient to get you through this. By the way, I just had this thought this morning, as a matter of fact, early on this morning. I didn't think about it till just now. I wonder This is the first time I've ever thought this. I wonder if Paul's thorn in the flesh was this reminder all the time of what he had done. Yeah, I guess I was thinking about that movie I watched recently about the torture of Christians under communist Russia. When Paul separated families and put people in prison, there was crying and wailing and screaming. Do you think that when Paul tortured people, that they just took it quietly? Do you think when they stoned Stephen to death and Paul's standing there watching it, you think he just kind of forgot about all that? I just wonder if that just those voices, that screaming just came back and haunted Paul all the time. Consequence of sin. And God said, my grace is sufficient. Sometimes there's cases of sickness that are directly attributable to Satan. You look in the New Testament and often you'll see a disease like very similar to epilepsy that is attributed to demon possession. That's Satan. So what happened here? Well, on top of all of his losses in the real physical world, now Job has to deal with this skin disease. What was it? I don't know. Look at the symptoms. These are all the symptoms that are given to us throughout the story of Job. Chapter 2, verse 8, he has severe itching. Chapter 2, verse 12, it disfigured him so that his friends didn't even know who he was. Chapter 7, verse 5, talks about scabs and sores, cracks in his skin that are oozing pus. Chapter 21, verse 6, he has fever and he has chills. Chapter 30, verse 30, he has a darkening of the skin. Same chapter, verse 27, he had diarrhea. Chapter 7, verse 4, he has delirium. Chapter 19, verse 17, he has bad breath. And chapter 30, verse 17, he has extreme pain. So what do you think it was? You know what? I don't care. I don't want any of those things. He had them all. We don't know for sure what it was. I'm sure modern diagnosis might connect this somehow with all of the emotional trauma that Job faced when he found out he lost everything in life that mattered to him and except God. And surely, to some extent, he would be diagnosed today as having post-traumatic stress disorder. What's he going to do? His day, there weren't a lot of doctors to go to, and he couldn't get a second opinion, so he just dealt with it. Verse 8, took a piece of pottery, was broken, scraped himself while he sat in the ashes, so that means he's out in the town dump, quarantined from most of society. Some of you know what that's like. That's emotional in itself. Did the best that he could to take care of his broken body with a broken piece of pottery. There's a little symbolism there, I think. It is a picture of a man who's just suffering deeply, is in deepest grief. Doing what he can. Handling the situation. Look at this varied response to the test as people were observing it. Job's wife, she's a little bit more emotional in this whole thing. You know, Job seems to be so collective, calm. That's the way it is. She's not exactly clear-headed, according to Job. Verse 9, his wife said, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Now, frankly, it's not really hard for us to be predisposed against Mrs. Job. This is really the only mention of her in the whole story, except for two very simple passing references that Job makes a little bit later on. Nothing about her. Notice she accuses Job with the exact same words that God used to commend Job. Isn't that interesting? Job says, God says to Satan, hey, Satan, look, Job still maintains his integrity. That's a wonderful thing. Job's wife says, you're still holding on to your integrity? Forget it. Curse God so that he's able to kill you and get you out of this misery. Well, I have to conclude, based on what little we see here, she's obviously not righteous, blameless, fearing God, and eschewing evil, like her husband was. Therefore, she's not very encouraging. She doesn't seem to be very sympathetic. Here's this guy suffering more than we can even imagine. How does he respond? He responds to her by saying, "Well, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil?" All this Job didn't sin with his lips. So unlike his wife, he didn't sin with his lips. In wisdom literature, and this is part of wisdom literature, I'd remind you, what a man says is what he is. You see it all through Proverbs. Proverbs 13, verse 3, for example, whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. A fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook, so that even Jesus would say, how can you speak good when you're evil? For out of the abundance of your heart, the mouth speaks. Job said, this is what I am. God gives, God takes away. Look at his three friends. They come out of sympathy when they heard what was going on. Verse 11, you have these three friends. They determine when they've heard this news, they're going to show sympathy. The last part of verse 11, they made an appointment together to come to show sympathy and comfort him. That's a fitting thing for us to do when you know somebody who is suffering. You show sympathy. But what you're going to discover is when you try to show sympathy, sometimes people are very, I don't know, maybe the word is pride. Proudful. And they don't want any sympathy. Folks, when you're suffering, let people help you. They saw what was happening, verse 12. Didn't even recognize him. They wept and mourned. They raised their voices. Verse 12, last part of the verse. They tear their robes. They sprinkle dust on their head. That's kind of just Middle Eastern culture. That's the way they would do that. But they were also very sympathetic. They identify with Job. It looks like they're also sitting in the ashes. They're sprinkling their dust, that dust on their heads. And they just sit down for 7 days and they don't even talk. Verse 13. Why? Well, you know, it's possible that they're just so overwhelmed by this suffering that Job was facing that they didn't have anything to say. More than that, what are they going to say? They're ignorant. They don't know what's going on. No one, none of these guys, no one including Job himself knows why this is happening. What do you say to somebody when you don't know what's going on in their life and you're trying to be sympathetic? You know what you say? Stuff you shouldn't say. Sometimes it's better just sit down. Just be there. No advice, no wisdom, no explanations. You're just there. Well, Job reminds us that suffering is just kind of part of this journey from the cradle to the grave. And there are times where suffering really appears to have no cause, has no solution. Let's always remember that we just don't know the details about what somebody is suffering or why they're suffering. We just don't know. Often they don't know. So what do we do? Well, we just maintain this confidence that we know God, we love God, and we trust God. We must believe that He knows all about the suffering and that He is in charge of the suffering. And the reason He's in charge of all the suffering that takes place in the lives of His people is because He is somehow going to bring glory to Himself. And we don't want to rob God of that glory. So when we suffer, we conclude with Job, shall we receive good from God and not receive evil? And we agree with Paul in the face of his suffering. He said, this is why I have this messenger from Satan. To keep me from being too elated by the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given to me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me. To keep me from being too elated, three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. And He said, my grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. When our friends suffer, we do well to be large on sympathy and small on advice. knowing full well that so much of the time we really don't know what God's doing. We just keep lifting our friend up to God, encouraging them in God. I know it doesn't make sense, but God knows.